Hello and welcome to Sportilix, the show about the business of sports here on KXSC 1560 AM and online at kxsc.org. As always, I am your host, Paresh Devay, here at the Ronald Tudor Campus Center at USC. Today, we are talking about managers, general managers, team executives, hirings, firings, and how that entire business behind the scenes gets done and how it affects the players on the field. We'll be speaking to Michael Kramer, who is now the executive director at the Texas Program of Sports and Media at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm sure that'll be a fascinating discussion. Later in the show, we'll be talking with Craig Escherich, the former head basketball coach of the Georgetown Hoyas, after John Thompson left that program, between John Thompsons, I guess. That's going to be another great story, and we're going to hear from him how that experience was. He was eventually fired, and Kramer probably was involved in some firings when he was president of the Texas Rangers and the Dallas Stars in the early 2000s. So now let us go ahead and bring you on, Michael. Can you hear us?
I can hear you. Glad to be here.
Great. So again, we're just sort of, the impetus for this show was kind of what we've seen in Boston the last few days, where the Red Sox had, I guess, an epic collapse, no better words to say it. They went 7-20 in the month of September. They decided not to renew Terry Francona's contract and bring him back for the 2012 season. They had an option on his contract. He basically, you know, was forced out in a sense. And now Theo Epstein, their general manager, is kind of in a bind. He doesn't know quite what he wants to do. At least that's what it seems like. The Chicago Cubs have expressed some interest in his services as general manager, but we'll see what happens there. But that whole dynamic of, you know, the team struggles, and then they're in this debate about when is it the right time to fire the manager, the general manager, the president, any sort of team executive behind the scenes, and how did that decision come up? So that was kind of the driving force behind this, our discussion today, or the reason to have it. And just sort of lay out the scene, Mr. Kramer, if you would, of what exactly the role of a president is. And if I'm correct, you were the president of both the Stars and the Rangers between 98 and 2004. So what exactly did you do in that role?
Well, it depends on the team, by the way. I was the president of both teams. I was also president of the holding company that owned the teams. But every professional baseball, professional sports team is set up a little bit differently. And you have active owners and you have inactive owners. There are teams and franchises where the president and CEO runs everything and the general manager of the team reports up to that person. In my particular role, I was president of the teams, but really was running the business of the team. So, you know, building stadiums and arenas, selling tickets, selling sponsorships, doing the marketing, and pretty much everything except selecting the players and in turn selecting the general manager. Our owner was primarily involved in doing that. We would sit and talk, but clearly the owner's decision controlled, and that's not unusual. You certainly are aware, your listeners are aware, that there are some pretty high profile owners in sports, including right there in your backyard. But, you know, George Steinbrenner with the Yankees and Dan Snyder with the Redskins, and, you know, the list goes on and on. So it really depends on what team and the extent of the ownership.
And was there ever, you know, a debate that maybe the owners shouldn't be so involved, that they, you know, they're the ones sort of holding the purse strings, and sometimes, you know, when money and emotion mix, it's not a good... It's not a good a batch of things in that same pot, I guess. So yeah. Was there ever times where you talked about, you know, maybe you should let me have this decision or whatever?
Sure. You know, I think it's discussed more in the newspapers and on radio and TV than it is in-house. You know, whether the owner should be involved, let's fire the owner and keep the general manager, you know, that... it happens a lot. But, you know, there were discussions that were had as to, hey, maybe on this one someone else ought to take the lead. But quite frankly, in our shop, the way we ran the Rangers and the Stars, our principal owner at the time, Tom Hicks, you know, made it very clear that the fun part for him was dealing with the GMs and of course, who reports to the GMs, and that's the manager and the players. And so it was actually fun for the owner. That's what he wanted to do. And there are many, many teams that are structured that way. Having said that, of course, when we're thinking about changing a general manager or a manager, you know, you talk about it as a group. And, you know, you have to consider the business. You have to consider what it'll do to the franchise. You'll have to consider what it does to selling tickets. And, you know, do we need to change the way that we operate? So there's a whole lot of factors that go into it. But usually it comes down to, you know, do you really think this is the right guy to run this team right now? And that could be a lot different than it was a year before or a year later.
And so walk me through maybe if we provide whatever insight you can into some of the decisions that were made while you were with the Rangers. And I'm more familiar with baseball. That's why I'm sticking to that sport over hockey. But you saw Johnny Oates resign back in 2001. Does resignations, do they blindside owners and team executives, or is it usually something that, you know, is hinted at by the manager that they're going to do
this?
Yeah,
it's, you know, it's funny. Johnny Oates was a great guy who died very, very young and died way too soon. He died a couple of years after he left the team. Mm-hmm. You know, it's often said that people are resigning, whether it's a general manager or the manager. Usually it's somewhat of a meeting of the minds. And the nice thing to do is to, you know, let the manager or the general manager say, hey, I've had it, I'm gone, I think it's time for me to leave. And that's what you're seeing playing out a little bit in Boston. It was probably management and ownership's decision that, you know, Terry Francona probably take a walk, and yet Terry Francona probably had thoughts that, hey, this isn't the best place for me. So there's probably a meeting of the minds, and that's what happened with Johnny Oates. We weren't doing well at the time. The team was struggling. And, you know, there's an old cliche, it's easier to get rid of the manager or the coach than it is for the 25 players. And so, you know, there was sort of a meeting of the minds with Johnny Oates that I think he knew that it wasn't the right time for him any longer, and he was ready to move on, and he truly was. He had family and grandchildren that he was dealing with, and there's a lot of outside factors. But on the part of management, I think management thought it was a good time to make a change because we wanted to see, you know, different performance on the field. And sometimes the only way you get the chance to do that without changing the whole team is to change the manager. And that's what happened.
And in a public sense, you know, resignation might look a little better for the manager. On the business side, is there any effects between a resignation or a firing?
Yeah, if the newspapers or media believe that the person has resigned, usually you get attacked for what did you do to this poor guy, and you know, you shouldn't have let him go. What kind of operation are you running there? You know, the guy left you, and shame on you. On the other hand, there are people in the media and of course fans who sort of understand as well that it probably wasn't a true resignation, that sometimes it's a mutual thing, or else the manager or the general manager was going to be fired. And so then you get castigated for how dare you fire this guy, or how dare you force him out the door. He was the best manager we've ever had. You won two pennants, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, you get attacked either way. And anything short of a person leaving to go off to become president of the United States, well, you know what? We did have one of those happen with the Rangers. You know, you get attacked. And so, you know, it's you can't win either way, and yet management has to make the decision that it's time or it's a good time to accept the resignation, or it's a good time to have this person leave. I think we need to move in a different direction.
And then afterwards, Jerry Nairn comes on board with the interim tag, which has to be one of the, you know, most awkward things in all of business when you get that little interim tag next to your name.
Yeah.
And what does it feel like to be in that position, do you think, for a manager, a general manager, for a president, for anyone to have that interim tag where you don't really know where you are?
Well, it's tough. On the other hand, Jerry Nairn was probably a good guy to step in at that point. The players knew him. He was well-liked, sort of a player's manager. He'd been around the organization. And for Jerry, I can't speak for sure for him, but I sense what, and I remember that the way he felt is that, okay, hey, look, I was a coach. I was making X number of dollars. Now I'm the manager, and even though I'm not the highest paid manager in baseball, I'm now making a whole lot more money, and I've got a chance to show on a national stage that I can do this. And so there's probably no real downside for the interim manager other than the fact that he probably knows he's being scrutinized heavily, doesn't have the beauty of a multi-year agreement, and he could be out on the street next year. And so the good news, bad news is that, okay, I'm now the manager, I'm making a ton more money, and I've got a chance to show it. The bad news is I might be out of a job next year, and it might take me quite a while to find another job, even a coach's job. So it's an interesting situation. Sometimes interim managers do very well, and they find themselves renewed. And in the case of Jerry, we actually brought him back after the interim tag was gone. But it wasn't long before, you know, he was gone. So, but he did fine. He ended up being a coach in several other places, and I think that he probably looked back and said it was a great experience, and I made a whole lot more money.
Do you ever see it come up where someone rejects an interim offer thinking that, you know, I don't want to be in that position, I'd rather have this safe, comfortable position, and does that ever backfire on them?
It probably has backfired. I know that there's been a couple of guys out there, in at least in baseball, and I think in football, and I'm struggling to come up with the names. Maybe I'll think about it before we're done here, but I know there are guys who have turned down becoming an interim manager because they just didn't want the hassle and felt like long-term this just doesn't work. I'd rather stay where I'm at and be a coach, and that's what I feel most comfortable. You know, does it hurt you down the road? Well, it could, especially if the organization that asks you to become the interim then says, well, then you're gone. Mm-hmm. Now you're sort of out in the cold with no job as opposed to a job that would have given you potentially more visibility and certainly a lot more money, at least in the short term.
And so that's a tough, I guess, a business strategy decision for that individual when they are offered that, pretty much like any other job then.
It is. I mean, it's you really have to look at it as a business, and these people are making decisions based on, you know, how they're going to function and where they're going to work the next day. And, you know, the problem with Major League Sports is that if you don't hook on with one of, say, 30 teams in your league, you're done. I mean, there just aren't that many jobs. So there's a lot of pressure on these guys. Many of them have been able to stay in the big leagues for 10, 15 years playing and another 25, 30 years as a manager and coach. And it's not a bad life if you get in that groove. But every day when a new owner comes in or a new general manager comes in, you might be out. So it's a tough life that way.
And then after a last place season in 2002, Nairn gets fired. When does that decision or that decision making process start? That, you know, the owner kind of says, I think maybe we should, you know, fire this guy at the end of the season.
Yeah, that was, you know, the team wasn't doing well, and it was probably, I can't tell you that I remember a date, but, you know, certainly there was a time during the season where, you know, we said, look, this isn't working. right about that time, we changed our general manager as well, Doug Melvin, who's done a tremendous job for the Brewers. Mm-hmm. And is still their general manager and has now brought them to the playoffs a couple times. Doug was on his way out with the Rangers as well. And again, it was a feeling we need to do something different. And so during that season, there was a lot of discussion about let's bring in a new top shelf general manager. Let's let the general manager help us pick a new manager. Well, when the dust had settled, we ended up with John Hart, who built a tremendous team over through the 1990s in Cleveland, and Buck Showalter, the ex-Yankee manager, was brought in to manage. And now looking back, that didn't work. Even you bring in some top shelf people, and you think about it for 6 months, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work.
And two questions come out of that, and one is, what's the difference when you're thinking about the hiring, firing decision for a general manager versus a manager? What different strategies or thinking is going on in between the two positions?
Well, it definitely takes a different talent. And right about that time, even though we're seeing it on the movie screens today with Moneyball, mm-hmm. right about that time was the time that Billy Beane was making some hay and is actually written about in Moneyball, was that early 2000s. And, you know, we were starting to think, certainly from an ownership and management standpoint, we're thinking, hey, wait a minute, there's a different way to do this. We certainly knew what was going on, and one of the people that we brought in as GM, we actually brought in a team to be general manager. We brought in, if you want to call it, the office of the general manager, and John Hart was brought in as our GM, but we brought in from those very same Oakland A's a guy named Grady Fuson, mm-hmm. As our assistant GM. And we really saw them working as a team, and ultimately, maybe down the road, Grady would take over for John. But you're looking for people that have, you know, this great baseball wisdom, and they think they know how they can build a team, and it really starts with the minor leagues and who can manage that and what kind of people do they know. It's really like hiring a CEO. And you're looking to find someone who knows people in certain areas and knows how to manage this little business that we call a Major League Baseball team. When you're looking for a manager, you're looking for a guy who can execute on the field. It's almost like finding the general who can operate out on the battlefield and knows what pieces to put in and what moves to make and has the respect of the players. And it's an interesting talent because not everyone's got it. And you're always hoping that you're going to find the right guy who's going to mesh with the team. Looking at what's happened with Boston with Terry Francona, and he, by the way, Terry was a coach of ours for a mm-hmm. year at the Rangers, so I got to know Terry a little bit. Terry had a great run for 8 years, probably the greatest run in Boston Red Sox history in the last 100 years, which isn't it's a dubious honor, I think. But he clearly had a great run. But most of those players now are getting older. The stars are getting older. Veritek and Ortiz and some of the others are getting older. And I sense that it just wasn't his team anymore. And that, you know, 8 years was enough of a run there. And that he couldn't make the moves and pull the trigger and get the guys doing the things that he wanted to do as well as he probably had before.
And when you're looking for a manager, a general manager, for players, there's, you know, scouts that you can send around and look at that. Are there scouts for managers and general managers? How do you find the person that fits perfectly?
That's a good question, because historically people have just, you just sort of know who the available talent is. For example, using Terry Francona again, the rumor is that he's going to go to the Cubs. And maybe be the manager there, and maybe Theo Epstein will go with him or take him along. And historically, a lot of the sports teams have simply just passed around their managers and coaches,
mm-hmm.
and even GMs, and there hasn't been, you know, any professional search, if you will, for who the right guy would be. And we probably broke the mold a little bit, even though we ended up with what I call two old baseball guys in John Hart and then ultimately with Buck Showalter. But we actually hired a firm out of Dallas run by a guy named Bob Bodine, who's a great guy and a great recruiter in the sports area. And we actually asked Bob to go out and to do a book for us, if you will, on all likely candidates. And we asked him to take a look at those people who wouldn't be normal, you know, top of the list type candidates that you would know in baseball. Well, interestingly, we ended up hiring a top of the list guy with John Hart. But Bob was the guy who came up with Grady Fuson, who was a couple steps down the ladder at Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And he put together a pretty good presentation on a number of candidates, and many of the candidates that surfaced weren't necessarily candidates that would have surfaced if we did it sort of the old baseball way, where you just start calling people who you know. And so I think people still do it that way, but we went out and actually did a search. And, you know, the results on that are probably mixed. We ended up with a couple baseball guys. We ended up with a guy that wouldn't necessarily have come. He ended up not having a tremendous impact on the organization because he left a couple of years later. So not sure that there's a better way.
Have any stats or something been developed that can, you know, we saw the move then away for players from scouts to all these statistics, and now we have reached a mix of it. Did we see a developing of stats to measure, you know, a good assistant GM or a good coach? Or has anything like that been developed that we can get to a sort of mix at some point?
I'm not aware of any, but boy, that would be a good subject of research at USC, you know, to do that. So, no, I don't know of any. I mean, certainly people in the organizations are judged on the talent that they draft, the talent that develops, the number of players that come up through your minor leagues, the number of players that come up in your system that you can use for trades. And historically, that's how people in that level are judged. And it's probably fair. If you end up losing all of your people because you keep trading them away, then it's probably not real fair. But, you know, usually those people, assistant general managers and directors of player personnel and development, are usually judged on, you know, over the course of time, how many players are we developing and are they finding their way to the big leagues? And that's probably it. I don't know of any studies that have been done to demonstrate that.
Well, two last questions in the last couple minutes we have here. One is, you know, when you brought in Hart and Showalter, those are all obviously big names, and they came with big price tags as well. Mm. What factor does money play into these firing and hiring decisions?
Yeah, it does play a role, and actually, we probably should have been very frugal buyers. As it turns out, the Rangers, as you know, didn't do so well and ended up filing bankruptcy last year. You know, our principal owner was Tom Hicks, as I mentioned, and if he were here and listening, and by the way, he's a USC grad as well. He went to Texas and USC. If he were listening, he would tell you that if he had the chance to do it all over again, he wouldn't just throw money. And the better thing would have been, probably at that time, would have been to find a solid baseball guy, maybe even a guy like Grady Fuson, who was not the top guy. Maybe not Grady, maybe somebody in that area. And we had some fairly talented young manager candidates that I thought would have done a very good job for us. We could have put them in. And we probably could have used either our own people or people that we could have developed for a much cheaper price and taken a longer-term approach to rebuilding the team. And instead, what happened at Texas, as well as a lot of other teams, is money was thrown at the problem, but money doesn't go out and score runs. And that was a problem.
And then a couple of years later, you decide to leave yourself. Why does that, or how do you come to that decision as a high-ranking executive?
Well, that was 6 years into it, and there's a lot of history there. But basically, when I came in 1999 to start that group called Southwest Sports Group and to merge the teams together, we had a number of challenges. We wanted to take both the Stars and the Rangers up to what we thought the level we should be at from a revenue generation standpoint. Both teams were down in the high teens, and yet we were in the seventh or eighth largest market in the United States. So we needed to do better there on revenue. We needed to put together a major TV deal or to start our own regional sports network. We had to build an arena in downtown Dallas, which we did. For the Stars, we needed to build a new spring training site, which we did. In Arizona, we needed to restructure our minor leagues, and we had our own TV station, blah, blah, blah. We had a lot of stuff going on, and 6 years into it, we had accomplished almost all of that, for me personally, it was a good time for me. A couple of my old partners called me and said, hey, how about going and buying a business and helping us with this new business up in the Northeast? And, it was a good time for me to do that. It didn't have anything to do with whether I liked sports or didn't like sports anymore. It was sort of, I'm going to move on and do something else. And that's how that happened. Had we won the World Series and the Stanley Cup the year before, would I have done it? Well, not sure. But I probably would have done it at some point.
So it was a decision sort of to go on to a new challenge. And the last question I'll give you a minute to answer or so is that I always ask my guests, are there any myths or things that you always hear about, you know, the sports management side, and I guess here specifically to hiring and firing, that you just don't think are correct and you want to say something to?
Oh, boy. And sports management in general? First of all, I'm not sure this answers your question, but sports management in general has become an academic subject over the last 10-15 years, and it's become much, 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 much better in the classroom than several years ago. I was personally out teaching at NYU for a few years before I came down here to UT to start this program, and we revamped the curriculum there and really upgraded. So I think sports management in the classroom is getting much better, and it's becoming much more of a business focus than it was before, where it was coming out of sort of a physical training type program. So across campuses in the United States, I'm happy to say that I've seen a tremendous increase in the quality of sports management programs at universities. In terms of things that actually happen in the sports world, I think that, as I alluded to before, throwing money at the problem is not the way to solve the performance of your teams or to get the best people. You have to develop your people much like you do in a normal business, a non-sports business. And it isn't always getting the highest paid person. It's getting the person that fits. And I think that's why the Red Sox won a few years ago. I think they had good fits. I think that's why the Rangers won last year and why they're winning this year. And there's lots and lots of examples of that. And I think we get caught up too much in the sports business world of throwing money after problems. It's not a coincidence that the Yankees haven't won a World Series in a long time. I mean, 10 years for them, or almost 10 years, even though they historically spend way more money than anyone else. you don't necessarily win by spending money. And I think that people who run sports businesses that are good stewards of the business and efficient, and then they find the right people and not spend too the great amounts of money, are always going to be the most successful in the long run.
And you've been a great fit for our discussion today. Michael Kramer, the executive director of the Texas Program in Sports and Media, the University of Texas, Austin. Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Kramer. Really appreciated you walking us through some of those decisions made while you were the head over at the Texas Rangers.
Happy to do it. And hey, say hi to Craig for me. I know Craig Ashrick very well. Tell him I said hi.
I definitely will. Thank you for joining us again.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Again, Michael Kramer, Executive Director of the Texas Program in Sports and Media at the University of Texas at Austin. We're going to take a quick break and then continue our discussion here about sports management, hiring and firing decisions. Hello and welcome back to Sportilix, the show about the business of sports on 1560 AM and online at KEXSC.org. As always, I am your host, Paresh Devay. We're talking about the hiring and firing decisions on the sports side today. Just had a great discussion with Michael Kramer of the University of Texas at Austin. He says hi to you, by the way, Mr. Ashrick. And now we're about to start our discussion with Craig Ashrick, a assistant professor of sports management at George Mason University and the former head coach of the Georgetown Hoyas basketball team. And Craig, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Great. So again, just to lay it out, the reason for having this discussion today was sort of what's been happening with the Boston Red Sox the past couple days, with the team letting go of Terry Francona and now general manager Theo Epstein in kind of a bind where he doesn't know where he wants to go. Or, I mean, should he stay? Should he go? Should he go to the Cubs? And that whole situation out there kind of intrigued me. And just kind of want to delve into how decisions are made to, you know, bring someone on board or let someone go. And first, we can just start off by, you know, your discussion. You were a graduate assistant under John Thompson with Georgetown, and that's how you kind of got your start into the coaching side. What was that experience like, and how does that help?
I came into coaching almost by accident because my original intent, I had gone to law school, and my original intent was to become a lawyer and practice law or become a general counsel for a business and then maybe become a coach for my kids' teams or may just do it part-time. And I really fell into it totally by accident. It was a very enjoyable educational working at Georgetown, and I decided that this was something that I needed to try because I enjoyed coaching so much. I had become a member of the Washington, D.C. bar, and I had my law degree, and I figured I could always go back and practice law, but an opportunity like being an assistant coach for a program like Georgetown in the Big East may not always be there. So I ended up taking a job. I was a grad assistant first and then became an assistant coach after that. And, you know, looking back on it, I thought it was a great decision. Some of my law school classmates thought I was crazy, but once I became the head coach, they would have given their left arm to work for me. So I think they totally understood my thought process in relation to that.
And going from, you know, an assistant coach to the head coach, what was that transition like, and how did the interview process go? How did you get the job?
Well, there really was an interview process anywhere along the way. I mean, when I became the grad assistant, I had been basically interviewing for that job for 4 years when I played at Georgetown. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like I went into the office and applied for an opening as a grad assistant. I got offered that job. And just as I got offered the assistant coaching job, I got offered the head coaching job almost in the same way. John Thompson was going to leave. He decided to retire from coaching. He came to me and asked me if he leaves, would I want the job? And I said yes. He went and talked to the president of the university. He talked to the athletic director. The athletic director talked to the president. There were a couple other people involved in the discussions. And again, because I had been there for such a long time, I was interviewing for the head coaching job while I was an assistant, which was, you know, 17 and a half years. I was a player for 4 years, and I was a grad assistant for two. So they had 20 years to look me over. And so that was really the interview process more than anything else. And, you know, I got the job, and I thought I did a pretty good job. I won 103 games, and then I got fired, which is the subject of this radio show.
And before we get it, I want to delve into that, but before we do, how do you think that hiring process has changed from, you know, back when you were a coach to now?
My hiring process, Paresh, is a little bit different because I've been there for so long. You know,
but don't you think that still happens a lot in sports?
It does. Yeah, it does. I mean, there are some people that are, you know, at a university, at a college, at a high school, you know, at a professional team as a longtime assistants, and so they're certainly going to, you know, pop up as leading candidates for positions, and that's the way it should be. I mean, you should give preference to people that have performed and give an opportunity to people to move up the ladder. You don't ever, you know, as an organization, you don't ever want to run an organization where you're not going to give an opportunity for people to move up the ladder. I don't think that's a good way to run a university athletic department, nor do I think it's a good way to run a professional team. I mean, why would you tell or intimate to, you know, your players or your assistant coaches that, you know, you can play here, you can be an assistant coach, but you can never be a head coach, or you can never be a general manager? So I think that's a good policy to have, is to interview people. I mean, in L.A., meaning the Lakers, interviewed Brian Shaw, and the Lakers should have interviewed Brian Shaw. Mm-hmm. They ended up hiring a guy that had head coaching experience, Mike Brown from Cleveland, but the fact that Brian was interested in the job, the fact that Brian had been a loyal assistant coach to Phil Jackson. You know, I coached Brian for a little bit when I was an assistant coach with the Olympic team in 88. And Brian, I think, was a player at UCSB. And Brian was a very smart kid. He was a kid then. He's a young man now. And so I think Brian will make someone a very good head coach at some point. You know, the Lakers decided not to go in that direction, but they did interview him, and I think it's good that they did.
And do you think that the process in any way changes from the professional to the college? You seem to say that it can work in both sides, and that you should be hiring from, or looking to hire from, within.
I think you should at least, if you don't have candidates within your organization, you haven't done a very good job. If the Red Sox don't have scouts, assistant general managers, or former players within their organization that they can possibly hire, they haven't done a good job as an organization, because they should be building talent. Talent not only to play for the team, but talent also to manage the team within their minor league organization, talent to be a general manager. You know, assistant general managers should have the opportunity. If they don't have enough faith in the assistant general managers, then they didn't do a good job of hiring them to begin with. Now, one exception to that, and let me finish, is that if you want to, as an owner, decide, okay, this group of managers we have just did not do a good job, or I want to change the organizational culture, then I can see just going ahead and going in a different direction and hiring, you know, new scouts, new assistant managers. But the Red Sox have had pretty good success, so I can't imagine they don't have some people within the organization that they can't look at as coaches, as managers, and as general managers. I'd be very surprised if that's not the case.
And in a normal interview process, do you think that there's sort of one question that has to be asked and you need a really good answer from the candidate to that question? Is there something you just need to hear?
No, Paresh, I think you as quickly as you can in an interview process, and this is also why it's much easier to hire somebody that you've known for a long period of time, you have to get a feel for what this person's goals are with, you know, your organization. Is this person someone that, whose goals are to win a World Series? Is this person's goals, you know, to win in the way we want to win? You know, if you're coaching a college team, you know, what's your thought process in relation to academics? Is this person that we're bringing in somebody that's solely interested in winning games and could care less whether the players graduate or whether the players have a good experience educationally at the school? And I mean, there are some schools that don't mind that. And so that's in terms of hiring a college coach, hopefully that goes into the calculus, is what is this person's attitude towards academics? What's this person's attitudes towards kids graduating? Is this person someone that's really concerned with developing the person? In professional sports, that's not the case. Professional sports, you're paid to win. You have to develop your players, but develop them to become better professionals. You're not trying to develop someone from a freshman to a senior, be a better human being, better citizen, get a 4.0. I mean, that's not a professional team's concerns, nor should it be. I mean, their fans are paying to watch a team perform and play up to their capabilities, and they're not concerned whether or not, you know, someone knows how to spell supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. That's not a concern of a fan, I can tell you that.
And on the flip side, let's talk about the firing. You finish with a 103-74 record, and a few days before you get fired, you get a vote of confidence from the university president.
Yeah, imagine that.
We see that happen all the time in sports.
Yeah.
Explain that situation to me and why owners and presidents tend to do that.
I think you're talking to the wrong person. You'd have to ask the president of the university why he did that. I don't think I can explain that because I don't know how it is explainable. I'm sure he has a good answer. But
it happens so much in sports, though.
That type of thing is something, you know, I was coaching for 25 years, and so it was not something that I knew couldn't happen. Okay, I was not happy when it did. Okay, and nor should I have been happy when it did. But that is life that we lead. And when I say we, I mean general managers and coaches in the professional ranks. And when I say athletic directors and coaches at the major college ranks, I mean that's the nature of the business. Sometimes the winds change, sometimes major donors' attitudes change, and you have to be able to react as a president of a university that also needs major donors. So those types of things, that's part of the business. That's part of the business of higher education. That's part of the business of college athletics.
And we have the fire alarm is on in here, so I don't know what's
hear that.
Don't know what's going on. But
that must have been something I said, Paresh.
I'm going to put you on hold for a second.
Please do. An emergency has been reported in this building. Please cease operations and leave the building utilizing the nearest exit or fire exit stairway. Do not use elevators. Repeat, do not use elevators. Attention, attention. An emergency has been reported in this building. Please cease operations and leave the building utilizing the nearest...
has been reported in this building. Please cease operations and leave the building utilizing the nearest exit or fire exit stairway. Do not use elevators. Repeat, do not use elevators.
That sucks.
Attention, attention. An emergency has been reported in this building. Please cease operations and leave the building.
Craig, can you still hear us?
Somebody must not like you.
I guess so. This is the first time this has happened. Kind of weird. I have two questions for you, so I'll just quickly ask them. One is, I kind of compared your situation to what I'm seeing with Rick Neuheisel out here in UCLA, where the fans are, you know, clamoring for a change. How does it feel for a coach in that situation? And do you start making preparations thinking that you might get fired when you see, you know, the fans rile up against you like that?
Well, I think most coaches make preparations for that when they take the job. And I think everybody, you know, would tell you that you know that you're in a position where there's not a lot of job security. I mean, you have to do the best job you can, and you have to move forward and try and block. You have to block out as much as you possibly can and focus on coaching your team. And, you know, with all the things that people have to deal with now with talk radio and tweeting and Facebook and all this stuff, I mean, it becomes more difficult. Fans have a greater voice in things like coaching, coaches getting hired and fired, and general managers getting hired and fired. So the noise out there is greater than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. You know, and just think about it in professional football, you have fantasy football.
I have to cut you off because I'm being told I should leave. So,
okay,
thank you for joining us, and I'll catch up with you.
Nice talking to you. All right.
Thank you.